my brains, and I hope I'm going to get more back from you than I did since we've got all these theorists assembled. So, first of all, let me tell you where Chalk River is. It's near the capital of Canada, Ottawa, 2 hours up the Ottawa Valley, and it's on the boundary between Ontario and Quebec. About 2,000 people work there, but they're mainly Atomic Energy of Canada. We're a very small group, the National Research Council, and we do experiments with the research reactor there. So we're about 20 people. So I'm going to tell you about some work I've done with a very bright student from Toronto over the last 3 years. This is the student in question. I'm sure you'll be hearing more of him. Formerly, he's Bob Bergeneau's student, but in practice, he's done all his Newton measurements with me on this particular set of materials, which are cuprates of the YBCO type. Other people at Chalk River have worked on this in tandem with polarized beams, and Zara Yamani, who just joined us. But perhaps the most important group is a group at University of British Columbia, particularly Ruching Liang, who's grown absolutely magnificent crystals. So I have 5 or 6 CCs crystals of these very nice superconducting materials with low mosaic spreads and very small fraction of impurities in them. So, of course, actually Walter Hardy is not just the organizer of the UBC group, he has actually machined things for me to do with making these crystals, which have been detwinned using stress. So I'm going to be talking about one set of crystals in which we have an oxygen ordered YBCO, so it's the closest thing you can get to a single crystal and have large volume. And the other people are collaborators I've had at different laboratories, at ISIS, Chris Frost, and then worked with Radu Colby and Roger Cowley, and at Johns Hopkins, some high resolution data we took last year, which was done with his cold Newton spectrometer. Here's a very familiar picture. It's a combination of the map to orient you of the various possible phases, antiferromagnetism, superconducting dome, the question in YBCO, which I'm working on, as to whether this is contiguous, or whether there's an intermediate phase, or whether that even crosses into the superconducting phase, as the muon people would have it, is an open question at present. So I'll concentrate on experiments that we've done in the underdoped region, meaning we're at 2/3 here of the full TC, and here we have about 1/5 of the full TC, very close to the edge. It's about 6% of doping, and I'll show you some of the results that we've been getting at these two concentrations. So those are the oxygen concentrations. These are believed to be the actual whole dopings in the plane. First of all, I'll start with the end result, or one of the end results, which is in the nature of a map again. So this is for the 60 degree superconductor. We've done measurements at low energies, and I'll introduce all the words. Stripe-like modulations, meaning that the spin response, if you scan in momentum through at a particular energy here, you see these dynamic stripe-like modulations with very short correlation range. Then comes a very intense resonance, which I'll show in more detail in a moment, at 53 millivolts. It's reduced from the optimally doped superconductor by about 3/4. And then in some measurements that we've just published in PhysRev this January, we have gone up to 100 millivolts, because there's been an issue as to what happens in this material where you've lost a long-range order. If you go to high energies, in fact, do you find some vestige of this incommensurate or stripe-like behavior at low energies? There's been Nature papers by Hayden suggesting there's a box-like structure. And what I show here is our results. I'm very close to the Hayden experiment, 6.5, but in an ordered, oxygen-ordered material. And these are, in fact, isotropic in space in the XY plane. So as a function of momentum, if you scan across in any direction, you find the same wave vectors for the response. And the pattern opens up as you go to high energy. Now you may say that's absolutely boring and uninteresting because that looks like a regular antiferromagnet. But spin waves. So I mentioned that these are not spin waves, they are paramagnetic excitations of a non-highly disordered system. And what is plotted here is merely the maximum. If you scan that way, you see a slight modulation, you plot that at the peak. So I think it's important to be very clear, not just with experts but experimenters, that this does not indicate a well-defined excitation. It can be resolved if you scan in momentum, but if you do a scan in energy, these are heavily overdamped. And in fact, we show here that comparison with the velocity of spin waves in the pure antiferromagnet, that the velocity of the high frequency excitation, which extrapolates back to the so-called pi-pi point, that's the antiferromagnetic point, in fact, is strongly reduced by about 40%. So there's been a renormalization of the velocity downwards, and also there's been a considerable damping in the excitations. We don't see any feature that might suggest this is a spin fermion kind of thing with very cleverly chosen damping, as in seen in one of the 6.85 experiments by Pilhas and the Kammer group. They have regions where they have no spin excitations at particular wave vectors. In 6.5, which is just slightly less doping, and therefore where the spin fluctuations are a little stronger, there's no sign of that. I won't mention the optic modes, in some sense that is a detail, but this is a system with two layers, a bilayer, so the modes divided even and odd modes, and we've measured those as well. Yes?
How does it make the link with, I think people in LLB in Saclay have done some experiment on this also, and they told me they never saw strides.
How this relates is that if you go to high energy, there is no evidence for stripes, there is no evidence for ladders, none of these are asymmetric features. If you go to very low energies, you see a modulation which is, in this case, in the perpendicular to the filled oxygen chains. So this has been seen in oxygen 6.6 and 6.5 by us. The MOOC experiments and my experiments, that's a low energy behavior. And it turns out that this modulation kicks in at about the same temperature, twice TC, that the resonance starts to pick up intensity.
So wait, so you claim that, what about the CDS and Bohr group, you claim that they didn't go to low enough energy?
No, I don't.
You didn't see it?
Well,
I
can't explain why they don't have data down here, but I can say that if you look over the last 10 years at this sort of concentration, there's very little data has been taken down to very low energies. This is a very, very weak signal down here, so there's a sensitivity problem.
Where are you in temperature here?
Cold.
Which one's the 1.6?
All of this data is in the superconducting phase.
State.
Yes.
Oh, does it disappear in the normal state, the stripe signal?
No. Does the resonance disappear in the normal state? No. Let me show you the data. Here is the, what is, if you look at the literature, you see this. Some people fit to some Gaussian or other as a single peak up at this energy, 33 or 41 millivolts for the optimally doped. What we see, let's start with the normal phase. If we look in the normal phase, chi double prime is linear in omega and then goes over kind of a broad hump. Many of the early experiments don't show this. Many of the theories predict that there is a d-density wave gap, so there will be no spectrum in the precursor phase, which is normal. We've disproved that. That certainly looks like a Fermi liquid coming up with some kind of hump at this energy, 30 millivolts. If you cool from above TC, which is this picture, the normal phase, to below TC here, then what happens is you lose spectral weight at low energies. I can show you a picture later if you're interested. As you go to lower energies, this is more and more removed, and that spectral weight is transferred up into this region here. So the resonance appears to acquire energy, spectral weight, from the low frequency fluctuations of the normal state. As you probably know, there's many explanations for the resonance. Of course, it's part of a spin band. It's just the lower, most obvious feature. But the spin fluctuations go on well above that.
So both modes correspond to commensurate, right? It's pi-pi.
Yes, this, both of these are just taken at pi-pi.
For incommensurate? For what you call stripes?
Well, I would call them incommensurate modulations rather than dynamic stripes. But in fact, the correlation range of the incommensurate behavior, which is in this region here, is very short also. So by sitting at this wave vector, we pick up the frequency dependence of the two umbrella-shaped arms that come up, which people call the stripes, or the X-shaped dispersion.
But still gives dots. It is 5-5, it's close, right?
Yes. What I'm saying is, you will still pick up intensity from... there is no zero at pi-pi. What is plotted in Mook's experiments and mine is just the maximum of a response function. But at pi pi itself, the intensity is non-zero. It's not like LSCO where you have sharp wave vectors with nothing at pi pi. In this material, there's very short-range incommensurate spin fluctuations. So I won't go through all these reasons. The one I tend to favor is this result here because it follows from a transfer of intensity. We've summed up the moment squared up to this energy and it seems to be conserved. So let's look at that resonance. You asked about is it present in the normal phase. If I look at the intensity, this is now the peak susceptibility, it's UV squared per EV. If I look at that, this is pi pi, it's just a different way of getting there. In fact, the resonance is not a feature that's only seen in the superconducting phase. You see a rapid acceleration in its growth, but the evidence we've got from three or four different ways of analyzing the data is that about 40% of the resonance is weight is already formed in the normal state. And if you believe that the fact that you get intensity pushed up from the low energies of an antiferromagnet by the gap, the pairing gap, as one possible explanation, then you would have to conclude that the fact we see something very similar, and I say that and that is quite similar, you've removed, added low frequency intensity, you've broadened things, then you'd have to say that local pairs are existing dynamically up here, but they never get coherent and superconducting. So let's move to another area. I'm now going to go above the resonance to very high energies.
Question?
Yes.
On what basis do you say it's local pairs that are producing it? I understood that you said that the gap forming seems to thrust weight upwards.
Yes.
But do you see weight being thrust upwards at around 200 Kelvin as it starts to form? Can you see that weight starting to move upwards?
This, I see this transfer beginning at about twice TC.
Okay.
Twice TC, you can start to see this incommensurate modulation. You can also see the resonance kicking in at the same time.
Okay. And that's where other people have seen the pseudo gap.
Yes, the T star from NMR is also of the order of 2 or 3 times TC. But if you're really keen to pursue that point, I'll show you a slide at the end. Ask the question at the end. I'll show you a direct comparison between the temperature difference of the neutron and the NMR relaxation rate.
But 2 TC is still way below the 200 Kelvin where it starts from the next view graph.
Here, this is very hard to see up here. You know, you're fighting against background to get this is almost negligible. I say 2 TC because I'm confident at 120K we've got a real signal when you do a Q scan, correlated peak at Q. Up here, it's an extension of an existing way of treating the data, so I don't consider that to be reliable. But the fact that it's still there is the main result.
Yes.
It's very strong. So we're now going to go to very high energies, which means I'm going above here to the right, and this is done on a spallation source at the UK, and what we see at high energies, if you go at the 33 millivolt energy of the resonance and you scan in QX and QY, the middle point being pi pi, half half, you can see a sharp ring with an intense localized in Q and localized in omega kind of excitation. If you go up above there, then you get a little hole in the middle, which is consistent with a cone of spin waves emanating from omega equals zero at pi pi and diverging with a finite velocity. Now, we've got this data, of course, at a whole bunch of energies, but the main conclusion is that at all these upper energies, there is no sign of an asymmetry. I could plot you the intensity and the radius at different energies, and it's just an isotropic cone of excitation with small modulation. Look at the smallness of the amplitude here. Color plots are very, very dangerous things, by the way, as I'm sure you're all aware. And so there's been a little bit of, surprise over the summer about these results being different from the ones where it seemed to show a box-like structure. I mention the box because those people who believe in ladders, which is a large fraction of the new industry of theory, let's calculate the spin fluctuations from ladders statically ordered, they calculated sort of diagonal blobs like this box-shaped structures. And so I'm terribly worried that some of my experimental colleagues may say, well, this is, I must be able to see this in my data if I look hard enough. Anyway, we do not.
What is the difference in intensity? Between the center and this white.
Oh, well, I know it's there. There's only 25% there, so in here it's a 10% effect. These are.
What would the error bars be on those intensities?
The error bar is a fluctuation you can see in the light. I don't know.
Okay, so those colors are within the error bar. Those fluctuations.
So. The bright is different than the blue.
Yeah. Looks like the box is warm.
If you really want to see the cuts through there, I have them at the back end of the talk. I could put them up for you if you like. Maybe that would that inspire you? I think I'll just go on with the talk.
It raises an interesting question about how colour plots should be presented so they don't give an indication of things that are within the error bars.
Yes.
If there were a way you could do that. Because it is useful to the eye for to see things, but you could, the eye interprets patterns, it loves to do that.
Yes,
right?
Well, so canals and marsh, as we know, yes.
So you think that box structure is within your noise?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we do this statistically. We just take all the data, and it doesn't matter whether we analyze it as polar averages or not. There is no anisotropy. I've got a set of scans in four directions, and the radius out from the center and the peak intensity on that ring is constant. There is no anisotropy.
Is the anisotropy that you, let's put it this way, could it be that there's a level of anisotropy there that comes from stripes, but your resolution isn't enough to resolve it?
Of course. Of course. You're saying if it's something very small, we might not be able to see it. I agree with that.
But okay, but how much in magnitude would be expected from a stripe model? Do the models give some estimate of how big that modulation would actually be?
Yes.
Would it be small or large compared to what you see?
The Ulrich and what have you know, there's an whole slew of theoretical papers on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they give a very strong structure. Because the models, if you put in static strike, we've done our own calculation on that, assume a static spin wave, static order. There's no static spin order in these things. They're far from anti-ferromagnetic. So it's just a kind of heuristic model. There aren't any anything would affect a high frequency fluctuation. So when you're up at 70 to 100 millivolts, it just doesn't care about whether at 10 millivolts there seems to be some incremental step-like modulations. Forces J are just too big for that. So you might say if there are dynamic stripes, they're very weakly pinned, they're wandering around. So here's another map for you. I want to emphasize how weak the modulation is in Q. You can see that if you do a scan here, you get two peaks, you run over two ridges here. Here's a strong resonance, no arguing about that. But this is what you call a paramagnon velocity from using a word that dates from a long time ago. I also like to mention that if you take the half height in Q scans of the resonance, it's very comparable with the width from going across these incommensurate structures at lower energy. Let's look at some incommensurate structures. This is the way we've analyzed our data. We have a material in which the order consists of oxygen order along the B direction. So imagine all the atoms, oxygen chains, every second one is filled along B. And so we do an experiment by scanning along the A direction, the X direction. And what you find is a rather broad flat top curve. It's with many of these, and we have them at different energies and at different temperatures. They exist below and above TC. You see a broad flat top curve. If instead of that you scan in the Y direction, that's perpendicular to the oxygen chains, you see a commensurate peak, which is we're riding up over a saddle point between these two things. If you scan at 45 degrees, you find also a commensurate peak. So it's only when you go in this direction that you see any kind of incommensurate feature. The red line here is a model of antiphase domain. You've got a block of spin in Nail state 1, and then over here you've got another block of spins in Nail state 2. You just turn them all over. And why have you done that? It's because you're expecting that there's a charge region in between which has got a ferromagnetic bond from one side to the other. This is an expected result for this material, but if you across a hole you get a ferromagnetic coupling. So that then cancels out the intensity at pi and moves the spectral wave out to the sides. So the model fits, but the model for this YBCO indicates a very short correlation range. Maybe 8 cells is the charge periodicity, and 7 cells is the correlation range. So they're barely defined.
That it seems that effective correlation is 30 angstrom.
Pardon?
If I look at half width of this peak, this lower peak, or whatever, correlation length is about 30 angstrom.
I didn't say what it is. I said it was 7 cells. Yeah, it's 28 angstroms, that's right. Yeah. So then, of course, if you do that, you've been reading the STM, scanning tunneling microscope, measures the charge in the planes. Seamus Davis and others, Capitonic, have done fantastic jobs producing by Fourier transforming wave vectors from this STM. So I got interested in this because of a paper by Christensen and Apley and Des McMorrow last summer, in which they plotted the spin wave vector against half the charge wave vector. You expect these antiphase domains, if the rivers of charge are every 8 spins, the spin pattern will repeat every 16. So that's why there's 2-to-1 ratio. Now I don't, that was for optimally built, but if I take our data for 6.5, I just plot them here. Chalk River data here are these red points here at 12.5 millivolts and downwards. MAPS data from that high acceleration experiment is the blue, and the STM from Seamus Davis and Jenny Hoffman is shown here. This looks absolutely marvelous. It goes right up to 33 millivolts. It's 41 for the optimally doped. So one gets really interested in this physics that the spin and the charge, one is driving the other. And from Mr. Landau, what we might expect, that the only way a charge fluctuation can influence a spin is two spins could drive one charge, hence the relationship between delta spin being twice half of delta charge.
So, on your focus transparency, how did you make the link between the visco data and the
way you see it? Well, I did a bit of little scaling there. First of all, I know what the doping is. The doping determines how far the incommensurate wave vector is from here. So I scale for the doping, 9% versus 16%. And also the energies come from 41 to 33 millivolts. So that's the only way I can compare an underdoped material with disco, which was optimally doped. It was
but actually in LSCO it scales linearly, it's going up to 12% and then it's getting non-linear. So about 12% is linear scaling is
dangerous. Let me assure you, this is not a thing to worry about. You should forget about this slide right now. Because I was all excited about this in September, and then I remembered that if you take the Seamus Davis data and go in a different direction, 45 degrees to the copper oxide bond direction, they discovered that as the energy went up, their wave vector went out. So I said, oh, well, let's look at the neutron data. It should do the same thing if this is generally applicable. No such thing. That's the neutron data. That's the black points here going up. And so there is absolutely no correlation one to the other. It just happened to be an accident that worked out in the 100 direction. If somebody can think of a reason, great. But I'm going to forget about this connection between spin wave vectors and charge wave vectors because it's not general. I noticed, I thought Doug might be coming, so I thought I'd mention his paper. He's saying that it's very hard in the PDJ model to get this checkerboard or 4x4 pattern. Okay, now I'm going to switch to the thing I'm most interested in right now, which is a material that's very, very close to the edge of the superconducting dome. It's about 6% doping, and it's believed that the critical doping is 5.5%. So we're within 10% of the critical doping. I just want to contrast what is seen between the material I've just been talking about, which is 6.559K superconductor, and we've got this behavior, looks like this at low temperatures, this resonance behavior, very, very sharp cut off on the upper end. If you then just pull out some of these holes, or don't put as many in, instead of seeing the magnetic response at 33 millivolts, you see it down here at about 2 or 3 millivolts. So this is the first thing we looked at. We saw this Lorentzian type behavior. This is relaxational. It doesn't. Its width is bigger than its frequency. So let's see if that's got interesting properties versus temperature. That modified Lorentzian has an amplitude that grows in from quite high temperatures, and it goes in and saturates down at low temperatures, below about 20 Kelvin. And if you look at the relaxation rate, that's the full width, half of that, as a function of temperature, indeed it gets slower and slower as you go to low temperatures, and it levels off at about 4, which is 2 millivolts for gamma. So to begin with, we thought that's the end of it. It's quite interesting, a factor of 10 lower energy than the resonance in pure material. It's the main feature in the spectrum. And so we believe that this is the overdamped resonance. As you go to the edge of the superconducting dome, that energy is moved down in a fairly critical fashion. It is not going down as the doping, which is only a factor of 2/3, it's going down by an order of magnitude.
And the ratio of the critical temperature is the same?
Well, its ratio of the critical temperatures is 60 to 20, it's a factor of 3.
Resonance frequency to critical temperature.
Yes.
It's the same.
They scale together. Yes.
This is my question.
Yes.
Is the ratio?
Yes. I think you're just really talking about this slide because I haven't put in critical temperature in here. I put in whole doping. But the critical TC goes up from 5.5% just like this. And these are a plot of all the resonance energies measured to date, including our 6.5. That occurs at about 3 or 4 times KTC, this energy here. So here we have our new result at 6%, and that relaxation rate, which I'm plotting, not a sharp frequency, but the main feature occurs at 2 millivolts, looks like that. I think this is very suggestive because this curve, the red curve, is just P minus PC to the square root. So that's what looks like a mean field soft mode
behavior.
There have been predictions like that by Chubukov, Satchev, and Ye in 1994, and by in the SO5 theory of Zhang as well. The data, if you take all the new data, it seems to follow that curve. The resonance frequency is not something that points down to zero doping. People who believe in ladders and in some of these stripe structures would have things going down beyond here. They would not cut down to a very, very low energy suddenly near this critical concentration for superconductivity.
You only have one. This conclusion depends on one point.
It depends on one point. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
So that what could be wrong with that point? First of all, it's not a sharp resonance. It's overdone. If I tell you it takes me about a year and a half to do one of these crystals, you understand why I've only got 2 data points there and there.
Yes.
All the others are taken by other people. But it's quite hard work. And I'm going to have another point by next summer. Yes.
You estimate a correlation length of the magnetic order at pi.
Yes. First of all, there's no long-range order, magnetic order. The correlation range is about 8 cells within the plane. And it is 1 cell between the planes. And it's got, not by looking at the inelastic feature, this is slightly dynamic.
Yeah.
It's the next thing I'm going to show, which was the biggest surprise to me in all of this. by the way, when I showed this at the Sitges meeting, I thought I'd get a lot of flack for this comment, and Bill Anderson got up and said, I always thought it was this resonance was a soft mode of a superconducting dome. Okay, good. Anyway, the thing that I found quite surprising, this is what I've just been showing you, but it's taken now with much higher resolution, cold neutron experiment at NIST. And in here, we see an elastic feature, we're down at 2 Kelvin. So this is still the pi point, very, very much narrow energy, 0.08 millivolts. So just to put you into memory, 0.08 is 30 times less than this sort of thing, this energy here, and that in turn compared with a higher doping is another factor of 10. So we came to very low energy scales, and to begin with you might say, okay, there's 2 things. What is this? Is that a Bragg peak? It looks elastic at this temperature. But are these 2 things coupled? Is that really part of one spectral function? So the first thing is the cynics among us, and John, I'm expecting to ask a question, and is asking whether it's a two-phase system that will get ordered antiferromagnetically. Yeah, they're nodding their heads, I can see that.
Calculation.
You just have to take the total moment, add it up. This is for that relaxational piece. This is that very narrow central peak. That's the spectral weight, integrating up under the total moment sum rule. If you add the 2 together, it's more or less constant. What you lose from the modified Lorentzian, basically because n of omega is going down, you gain in the central peak. So this is evidence for 2 things. I believe it's evidence that we have a single phase sample. It's not because we've got macroscopic different phases. It's part of the physics, and we're getting more or less the moment you'd expect for up to 32 millivolts if you integrate, just taking the results for the pure antiferromagnet, up to the same sort of energy. So let's go on and probe into this. Of course, measuring something at zero energy, there's always a whole bunch of nuclear garbage scattering you've got to get rid of. Polarized neutrons are absolutely essential. So I show you this for a number of reasons. First of all, it's the same It's the same pattern, just looks a bit different. It's less resolution because it's polarized. The main thing to take away from this is by looking at the right-hand side here, I have data for the relaxational piece, modified Lorentzian, and data for zero energy, that's the central peak. Horizontal field, vertical field is just Newton Guy's technical language for saying if that ratio is 2:1, you are looking at unpolarized spin excitations. If you have a preference for XY or out-of-plane fluctuations, that ratio would differ from 1. And we're finding we get a 2:1 ratio for all energies, whether we're at zero energy or on this inelastic stuff as well. And I've written it down in a different way over here, that we've got isotropic spin fluctuations. We're not, in other words, approaching an anti-ferromagnetic phase transition where you expect the spins to go into the XY plane. We're very far, we believe, from any anti-ferromagnetic fluctuation. And Oleg, thank you very much, told me that in fact that idea that the spins should spread apart when you introduce holes comes from a long time ago. I think that's 1989 or something, Simon and Sigier. To allow the holes to move, it's favorable for the spins to cant over. Anyway, what we have is spins pointing equally in all directions, very short range in space itself, very slow in time. Now the spatial resolution, how do I know that? That is by looking at the width here, the half width at half height, the scanning in the basal plane direction, so the inverse of that corresponds to itself. So you might say, is it Bragg-like? It's not Bragg-like because of the short correlation range. It's even shorter correlation range when you look at the coupling between one plane and the next, one cell and the next. It's this curve that I've put through the graph, through the data point here, is in fact just taking the bilayer model. This is a YBCO has two layers, and within a unit cell, another unit cell, a little distance C away. So if you just take the bilayer structure factor, which corresponds to anti-federal fluctuations, and then let it decay in the C direction, that gives you a perfect fit to the data we've collected. So this glass-like material has a knowledge of the three-dimensional structure to which it is going to attain at quite a bit lower doping.
But it's not static. You're saying that it's dynamical, but the time scales are slow, meaning the neutrons, what, 10 to the minus 8?
10.07 millivolts is the narrowest we can resolve. And at any finite temperature that we've measured, above, say, 5K, we can measure how slow these fluctuations are. But we run out of steam about 2K. And I'll show you that picture in a moment. Let me first of all say that we're in a region of very strong fluctuations. At 6%, we're just about to get out of the superconducting dome, not necessarily go magnetic. Look at the amplitude of this central mode. It goes right through TC. We can't see any break in the amplitude. There is something that comes later, but the strong spin fluctuations are really pushing around this superconducting pairs. Now, if you think about this, it doesn't diverge, by the way. This is very small intensity, really, compared with a Bragg peak. So this is definitely nothing to do with Bragg. But I think it also means where a theoretical help would be appreciated. If you have something that's very, very narrow at zero energy, it does mean that you've got a finite density of states. So, okay, it's about chi double prime's bound to be linear in omega, but the coefficient makes it a very, very steep function. So I think that should have an effect on the specific heat resistivity and the thermal conductivity, which you maybe know Louis Taillefer's measured, and it continues right beyond the superconducting dome. There's a recent paper in the archive on that. So let's look at what we see versus temperature. This is just a repeat of what I've shown before. But I want rather to show you the only thing that does respond to the possibly to TC is the full width of half height of this peak. So in the previous pictures I showed you scans in energy, it is very, very narrow. Well, maybe that's the narrowest picture here, 0.08. So what I'm plotting is this width here versus temperature to see what happens. And there's some small evidence that the relaxational, the width of that central peak goes down and becomes resolution limited. We can't say anything about it before then. I can't say that it's become strictly elastic and therefore is a perfect glass, because we can't measure it. It could continue to get slower down to millikelvin region, but that's what the data says. Now, some scaling in this material, which is the left-hand panel, omega over t scaling, is followed rather well. This is the data for all our inelastic data right up to 30 millivolts, you see 30 right down to the lowest energy, not central mode, and omega over t scaling is followed extremely well. These coefficients are almost the same as the ones that were used for, I think it was LISCO about 10 years ago, which is rather remarkable. The actual coefficients of the scaling are the same. If you went to that higher doping material I first talked about, the 60V superconductor, there's a very limited range over which you get scaling. In fact, there's a cutoff at about 20 millivolts. And we know the excitations, of course, go up to 100, but this is about, we've got data well up beyond 40 millivolts. So there's no question of having the data, it's just the scaling breaks down completely in the most strongly superconducting material. So if you like, you could say, if you think you're near a critical point, you're certainly going to be a lot nearer it in the low doping material, this one with the 6% doping rather than the 9%, and I would have thought that would indicate one is further from any quantum critical point. Of course, this is much closer in practice to where people say there's something funny going on underneath the dome, but I don't see any evidence of that from the neutron data. Now, this central mode, inelastic mode, reminds you, those who've worked on structural phase transitions, of a well-known phenomenon in strontium titanate and several other materials. Here's something with a triplet molecule oscillating like that, and it just goes soft and makes an antiferroelectric. But before it does so, there's a central piece, very slow relaxational piece appears. And Steve Shapiro and John Axe, Brookhaven, the theorists Hawker and Bollmer came up with the model for this. And basically, it just says, I've got a soft mode here, omega naught's its frequency, this is susceptibility. I've got a damping term, which is a fixed and dull kind of piece, and then there's a resonant piece of the damping that kicks in because you're coupling the soft mode to a very slowly relaxing object of some sort. In that case, they call it a defect. We'll talk about that in a moment. These red lines are, in fact, fits to this model. I've written down the parameters to show what they really are. This is a very, very slow relaxation rate for that central peak here. Delta is just a coupling parameter between the fast modes and the slow modes. I should also mention that this occurs in pure magnetic systems. It's not just because of antiferroelectrics. I mean, I've seen central modes and things with single ground state, triple excited states, and you can get it from the electron density giving you some in a heavy ferrite material as well. Anyway, this fits the results rather beautifully and with one function. If you look at the parameters, you see the soft mode frequency goes down as you cool down, and this relaxation rate, the full width of half maximum of the central mode itself, which is this block here, comes down very dramatically and continues to get smaller and smaller relaxation rate as you cool down. These are indeed measurable, and TC's in here. Now, what is this slow object? Here's a nice simple picture, which maybe is an extreme cartoon, which at least is consistent with what we see. Imagine this is the two-dimensional plane. And let's imagine that we've got a region here where the spins are antiferrocorrelated correlated with short-range correlation. The Newton experiment says that's about 8 cells across. There's got to be some charge, and there's got to be some superconductivity. So let's imagine that around about these regions at the edges, just like we saw in the 6.5 with the antiphase domains, that's where you get the holes largely concentrated and where conduction can take place. And across the boundary from one blob, one island or cluster to the next, you have an antiphase domain. I've written that because if the first spin is down here, this first spin is up there, meaning it's pi out of phase, so it cancels. And the same when you go in this direction. So this experiment seems to suggest glassy spins confined in these antiphase islands. What is the object that's causing this very slow central mode relaxation? One thing that appeals to me anyway is that we have these islands. If it's an 8-spin correlation range, that's an awful lot of spins. And to turn 64 spins over is going to be a very slow process. So I think that's maybe what it is. And as the doping decreases, that means the spin islands get larger, the hopping rate will slow. And I think that's why we see a central mode very, very low doping when you're near the edge of the superconducting dome, but not at the high doping where there's no elastic setting seen whatsoever. I've mentioned this in the last slide. I think that they're coupled through a frustrated sort of region to the next antiphase, next antiferro correlated region. And this argument is just a symmetry argument. The fact that we see this coupling between the central mode intensity and the inelastic means that we've got two modes of the same symmetry, central and the soft mode, as it were. And possibly it means they're non-zero density of states. I don't know whether any of this gives evidence for a breaking of a spin rotational invariance. When you make glass, all the spins stop moving. There's nothing that I can see in the data that would differentiate between that. I also, by the way, don't believe in the muon experiments. You can say you've entered a phase transition, they call it a glass transition. I think things just get slower and slower, and eventually it drops out of the muon window. But anyway, if it's right and extends into the superconducting region, and it was actually a sharp transition as you underdope, that would be presumably would be a quantum critical point. I'd like to hear comments about that. The correlation range is very, very short. So I think that we're very far from the antiferromagnetic critical point, and it means that we don't have a contiguous antiferromagnetic phase and superconducting phase. Again, that contiguous phase has been published, or suggestion for it, by Nguyen results of SANA. Also, there's the Anders paper on resistivity extending, claiming that there's a TN extends right up to and into the superconducting region. We don't see that. So I think that's the main conclusions of the talk. I could give you a new phase diagram, not much different than the old, but some new words to go with it. One of the words is that up here at 9%, that's 60 degrees superconductor, you have a sharp sort of resonance feature here, but of course we know the spin waves go on up above that, they're opening up, and down at lower energies you see this incommensurate structure. If you, in this region, which is sort of substantially underdoped, but not extremely underdoped, you still have to explain why there seems to be a suppression of the charge. Down here, the suppression of the charge response, I think, is very large. I would expect that if we have these strong, strong spin correlations getting down to low energies, that the charge response will be pushed up to very high energies. So I haven't seen any sort of theories that say the stronger the spin fluctuations, the weaker the charge density up to the Pachyderm gap energy. But surely there must be something like that going on. When you see strong correlated copper spins, that should be reducing the low energy electronic density of states.
What does electrical charge, what does electrical resistance look like above TC? The crystal you're looking at?
Up here?
No, down, way down.
I don't know. I'm not sure what...
Is it insulating? Is it non-monotonic?
Anisotropic?
The in-plane,
like... The in-plane resistance.
Some sort of linear
covering
up like that.
Well, it's linear.
Above 20 Kelvin. I haven't actually had a look at that data yet. The UBC people tend to measure London penetration depth and not resistance per se. But of course, that should be a very easy measurement to make.
I think TIFA had crystals that were also to the left of the dome altogether, just a little bit further.
Correct.
And I recall those ones, I think she was saying, are weak insulators. The electrical resistance is pretty much weakly increasing as he cools. But
yes. But his main surprising result was in YBC. And you go in here, the thermal conductivity keeps going.
Yeah, he's something to the left of that point, but the thermal conductivity, you're saying, is. It looks the same as it does in the superconducting phase.
Exactly, yes.
And the electrical resistance, of course, is not zero, but it's not strongly insulating, and it's...
LSU, when you get out of the superconducting dome, the resistance immediately starts to look semiconducting.
I think it's popping.
Yeah. So that's my opinion. The strong spins suppress the charges up to this 100, 200 millivolt energy, and then they recover. By the time you get to optimally doped, these fermion models, spin fermions, start to work quite well. But I think that's the end. Okay?
I want to make a comment. This is pretty wonderful data. The thermal conductivity measurements of TIFA, where the thermal conductivity looks the same in the insulating and not superconducting phase, certainly suggest that one should be still thinking nodal fuzzy particles, point-like nodes. And if one has point-like nodes and one doesn't have a breaking of translational symmetry or a doubling of the unit cell, as one would have if one has Bragg peaks, at pi and get a quarter, which your data shows one doesn't have. It really looks like one's dealing with a translationally invariant, skin liquid type, perhaps metallic phase in that region, which is extremely interesting, actually, I think.
Yeah. I wonder.
It's not strongly insulating. It's not activated at all. It's not very range hopping.
That's to the left of the dome. I remember that now. But I've been wondering whether having this very strong density of state at near zero energy could not in fact carry a lot of the thermal conductivity. People talk about that in terms of always charge, but anything will carry heat. Leaving photons out of it, which are going to, at least they have no phase space eventually. But
it looks like what
this has got extended in Q, narrow in omega. That means it's a finite amount of density. But you can't have a velocity that you need to get the thermal conductivity. But I've tried persuading Louis to think about this as one of the components of that conductivity. Well, I suspect that if I go to the left of the superconducting dome, when you still have an even stronger center peak. And it will be the thing that will finally diverge as you move to the anti-ferro point, and the correlations will just narrow up in Q. But I haven't done that measurement.
But what are the prospects of getting samples which are not superconducting?
Well, I was hoping to get one. It was going to have a TC of minus 3 Kelvin.
Okay.
That's just perfect. And Wu Qing just emailed me last week and said he just sent it over to Chalk River. In fact, it's got a temperature of plus 4 Kelvin. However, in this region, the oxygen, as you probably know, is very mobile. All I had to do to make it non-superconducting, I heat it up to 40 degrees Celsius and then cool it down, it'll be non-superconducting. When you look at room temperature, it comes back up to 4K. So we're going to play this game. The trouble is, of course, if you heat it to 40 Celsius, you've introduced a little bit of oxygen disorder. So it's not quite the same sample, but stoichiometrically, it's exactly the same sample. So the doping in the plane should be the same.
How sharp are those superconducting transitions?
1.5 Kelvin.
Yeah.
At 18 Kelvin, yeah. This is a triumph. I mean, to get it that sharp is amazing. Especially in these crystals, they're literally 6 cc's, 6 different crystals, all with the same sharp TC.
Last week we had Chris Pandogopoulos from Cambridge, who was doing the lanthanum-strontium copper oxide. And he had an array of bulk measurements showing a spin glass freezing and then all the precursor effects to that.
Yes.
That was his claim. And finally, working it into the window of the USR. And the glassy freezing usually covers vast ranges of times. And you're probing mainly the high frequency windows with the neutron scattering. It would be very essential to try to do low frequency measurements like AC susceptibility, field cooling, zero field cooling in that regime. And in particular, with a low superconducting temperature, you can see all of this. And that's why, again, the need for a slightly to the left crystal would be really essential to try to get more information about this antiferromagnetic domain or antiferromagnetic clusters.
Yes, we could certainly do that. You could go down 2 orders of magnitude in energy resolution and increase relaxation times. I'm not convinced that suddenly some entirely new physics will come out of that.
No.
I think it's just, it looks like things are going away exponentially in relaxation time. I think...
That's the difficulty of proving a spin glass, is how fast it goes away. If it's a superpower magnet, it also goes away exponentially.
But I'm resisting the tendency to call this a spin glass. Because the history of condensed matter physics is, if you don't understand the system, you call it a glass of some sort. And I would much rather, I was delighted when we saw the central mole, because there we're actually seeing some specific spectral features that might give you a clue to what are the objects that are slowing down. So I think there's a lot of work to be done versus doping in this energy range. This is a huge energy range, you know, 0.07 millivolts up to 30 millivolts. That's quite a 400, 500 to 1 range in energy already. So.
But I want to mention, maybe to comment, that if you, this is absolutely correct, you go below the low, non-superconductivity. But then it's very important to measure usual conductivity in the same samples. And this crystallizes, which is known for LSCO, right? And which crystallizes is going to do now down to millikelvin. Very, very important.
I'll make a comment on resistivity, not my usual one. Getting the voltmeter out in the lab is the easiest thing to do. Measuring the resistivity is very, very difficult. If you take a sample like this near the edge of the superconducting dome, it is any kind of small fluctuations, even in an exceedingly good crystal, you have one shot through the crystal and you think you've got a 40 degree K superconductor. So most of the measurements of resistivity in this region are basically incorrect.
But this is what I'm saying, if you do neutron measurements in some sample, and you are sure that this is below, right, it's not superconducting.
Yes.
And to do measurements of resistivity to the same sample.
No, no, no. What I'm saying is, even if you...
There's no cluster of superconductivity. You wait for the lab, look at the conductivity,
yes,
look at the glassy behavior, and that
is yes,
undisturbed by the superconductivity.
If you're way above, away from the superconducting region, resistivity works. But if you're anywhere in this region, you know, you can have a... Suppose you have a narrow channel of connected superconducting regions. It's zero energy, zero resistance. It means nothing. It's not the measurement of the bulk properties. So Meissner effect is that not the resistance. So the UBC people, and I now recall why they haven't measured the resistance. They think it's just hopeless to use that in these, when you're very close to the edge of superconductivity. In fact, there's people have published, even from their group, when they've had to change it because of this shorting problem.
Why is not a problem for LSU? The reliable data
exists. I expect that it is a problem.
It is a problem.
Yeah.
Is there a well-established data which nobody actually disagrees?
Well, no one's going to disagree with things which show a semiconducting upturn, because that means you measure resistance. The point is, if you measure zero resistance, it doesn't mean you've got a bulk superconductor.
Any other questions for Bill? Well, thanks very much. Bill's going to be here till the end of the week, till Thursday, right?
Friday. All week.
Yeah.